Good morning and welcome to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. A Louisville lawmaker who for years has been trying to give the working poor in Kentucky some tax relief is at it again in the current legislative session. Kentucky Public Radio's Tony McVeigh has the story.
For 6 years now, Louisville Representative Jim Wayne has been touting a comprehensive tax reform plan he says could generate much-needed revenue for the Commonwealth. And for 6 years, the bill has gone nowhere. One piece of it, lifting the income tax from the very poor, was approved in tax reforms passed in 2005, but other key facets of the legislation have languished. Ever the optimist, Representative Wayne is trying again. He recently outlined his 25-page bill to a House committee studying casino gambling. Why there? Because Louisville Representative Joni Jenkins, who chairs the committee, invited Wayne to appear.
So that the members of this committee would understand if for some reason the expanded gaming is not approved by the General Assembly, that there are alternatives that they can examine and study to help fill the state coffers during this time of crisis.
Wayne's bill would establish a state-earned income tax credit to assist working poor families, similar to the credit now offered by the federal government. It would extend the sales tax to services primarily used by the rich, like country club fees, and increase the tax rate on incomes over $85,000.
The rich are not paying their fair share in this state of state and local taxes. And what this bill does in a very simple, fair way is to increase slightly, probably not more than 1%, their state and local tax burden.
Among those supporting the bill is Dana Beasley Brown, who grew up poor in western Kentucky, sharing a single-wide trailer with her parents and five brothers and sisters. She says Kentucky's deep poverty rate increased 26% from 2000 to 2005, yet a family of four living just above the poverty line pays more taxes in Kentucky than in any other state.
Tax time in my family was a stressful time because my parents could never figure out why they were taxed so much when they made so little.
Retired University of Louisville economist Dr. Peter Meyer likes the part of the bill that would separate Kentucky's estate tax from the federal estate tax, which is being phased out. Meyer says by continuing to tax estates over $1 million, Kentucky could generate $40 to $45 million a year.
Why should any individuals or their family members be rewarded by the Commonwealth for their luck, which is in fact what we do if we do not in fact tax estates?
Another bill supporter is Dr. Sheila Schuster, who represents a coalition of human service agencies. She says with the state facing serious budget shortfalls, health services and education are being pitted against each other for dwindling state revenue. And that, she says, is not right.
We can have the absolutely best education system in the country, and if you have children sitting in that room that are abused, that are neglected, those children cannot benefit from the best education system that you have to offer.
Representative Wayne says his bill, if fully enacted, could generate $315 million in the first year and $250 million each year thereafter. No one spoke against the bill, but Louisville Representative Ron Krim does have some concerns about it.
I don't like when we segregate people. I don't like, you know, we say, well, you're in this class, you're in this class, you're in that class. You know, we're all Kentuckians. We're going to do something. We need to do it for all Kentuckians.
House Budget Chairman Harry Marberly, who last year called Representative Wayne, quote, the conscience of the General Assembly, promises to hold another hearing on the bill in the next couple of weeks. For Kentucky Public Radio, I'm Tony McVeigh in Frankfort.
An update to the two-year-old report, United We Stand, Encouraging Diversity in Kentucky's Leaders, shows Kentucky is losing ground in its number of racially diverse leaders. The statistics released by the Secretary of State's office show the biggest decline in school board officials, but other offices that experienced a drop included the Supreme Court and circuit courts. WFPL's Heidi Caravan spoke with Secretary of State Trey Grayson about the paper and what we can do to boost diversity levels in elected officials.
Tell me a little bit about this report. Where did it come from?
It was actually an update of a report we first issued in 2006. It studies diversity in leadership in Kentucky, both elected and non-elected positions. With the changes from the 2006 elections, with it being the largest elections in Kentucky's history, we decided we needed to do an update based upon those election results. And so we had some of our summer interns this summer calling through every city and county in Kentucky to identify what happened in the elections and find out what the results were. We knew from our first report that Kentucky does not have very diverse leadership, even considering the lack of diversity within our population. And unfortunately, at least in the elected officials, we saw a decline from 2006 to 2007. Most of that decline took place in school board races. But we went from having about 100 and almost 140 elected officials who were minority or to about 125 or so, give or take.
What do you think is happening here? Do you think that people of different diversities are not running for these jobs?
I think that's part of it. You know, I'd like to think that, and I'm not naive enough to think that there's no racism at all. I'd like to think that it's we have a catching up that we may have to do, and you know, you kind of have to work in politics. You kind of have to work your way up, start at the city races or local races, and work your way up the food chain is usually how it works. And so, as a state, we you know, most of our elected officials who are from diverse backgrounds are at the lower levels of politics, and they have to work their way up. And some will win, some will lose, some will find that it's not worth the sacrifices to serve. And I think the question is if we did this report in 10 years, we would hope to see an upward trend. The report that we did in 2006 was the first of its kind in Kentucky, so we really don't have a good comparison from the past. We have seen, I think, in some high-profile positions, some great successes. We have a U.S. cabinet secretary, Elaine Chao, who's Asian-American. Until he passed away, we had our first African-American Supreme Court justice. We now have our first African-American Court of Appeals judge. And we have several members of the General Assembly, including a committee chair, Chairman Darrell Owens of the House Elections Committee, who I work closely with on elections issues. So our hope is that maybe by highlighting some of these success stories and identifying folks who are in resources, that we'll see, you know, like I said, in 10 years, higher numbers that are more reflective of our population.
What can we do right now that's going to reflect a decade from now to try and get more diversity into these positions?
Well, I think what we can all help in this regard, and I think we can help in a manner in which we would all agree. I mean, basically, if when you see folks who are talented, regardless of race or gender or anything like that, but especially in some of the populations that don't see as many elected officials, you know, we should, I think, embrace them and help them out, encourage the candidates. I think the political parties owe it to themselves and to the state to recruit candidates who are diverse. And we're recording this today, and it's actually ironic that the Republicans are about ready to have a candidate for United States Congress who's African American. Irwin Roberts is a classmate of mine, and although today I found out that he probably isn't going to run because he's being called up to serve, but Irwin's candidacy, I think, would have been good for the Republican Party, win or lose, because I think people would have seen a smart, a successful African American running for Congress. And we're Republican or Democrat, we don't have that, doesn't happen too often. And so I think the parties can step up. I think individuals can step up and provide those opportunities and ask people to serve. I also think as a state government, we ought to reach out. I think this report is a tool. We want to spread this out, get it into the schools, and people can learn from Justice McAnulty's example, Secretary Child's example of folks who have decided to dedicate their lives to public service.
You've been listening to Kentucky Secretary of State Trey Grayson. He spoke with WFPL's Heidi Caravan about diversity among Kentucky's leaders. Last week, the University of Louisville released the results of a pilot program that gave social workers the task of rehabilitating criminals. The workers helped defendants enroll in drug and mental health treatment programs so they could avoid a return to jail. The university says the pilot was a success, saving the state millions of dollars in court and jail costs. WFPL's Gabe Bullard talks to the pilot's co-chair, Don Jenkins, about how the program works and where it could be headed.
Tell me a little bit about the pilot, please.
The social worker pilot that the Department of Public Advocacy spearheaded was funded by the 2006 Kentucky General Assembly at a time when incarceration was skyrocketing in Kentucky. I think at that time we had around 20,000 people who were in jails and prisons. And as a result, I think legislators wanted to know if there was a better way of dealing with persons who have a mental illness or substance abuse, and whether or not we could divert individuals to treatment as soon as they were appointed to the public defender. And so we placed a social worker in four pilot regions in Bowling Green, Covington, Kenton, Moorhead, and Owensboro. And so the pilot lasted a year, and the results have been astonishingly great.
Okay, what did these social workers do in the program?
The social workers get the case at the very onset when the court appoints the case to the public defender's office, and their job really is to identify individuals with mental signs, people with mental signs of mental illness or signs of substance abuse, and their job is to find treatment in the community because treatment obviously is not often available for individuals if they're sent to jail. So they identify the needs that the clients have and the resources in the community to better deal with those so that those individuals can get their treatment needs met and not come back into the criminal justice system later.
Okay, what kind of resources might be in a community like Moorhead or Owensboro for someone who might have drug problems?
Well, there are a lot of nonprofits. There are also comp cares that are available. I know that the comprehensive cares, there's one in North Keys in Northern Kentucky. Life Skills is in Bowling Green, excuse me. They're essentially comprehensive care treatment providers who are doing a really wonderful job in the community. And so our social workers work closely with those comp care providers, nonprofit agencies, and other treatment providers like Recovery Kentucky programs that Governor Fletcher supported. And those comp cares are really specialized. They have prescribed ways of treating the kinds of problems that, these defendants have. I mean, essentially, DPA, we serve, I guess, one half of our clients are illiterate. Around 56% of them have a mental illness. 67% of them have some sort of alcohol or drug addiction. And so just by warehousing them in a prison cell, we're really not restoring that individual or rehabilitating them and making them whole again. And so if we don't treat their root problem, then they're going to come back into jails and prisons and cost Kentucky, you know, money in the long run, and, you know, there are a lot of human collateral consequences as well.
Okay, so is the social worker kind of like a guardian to the person?
Well, they actually are assigned, they're trusted advocates, so that, you know, the clients trust them to be their advocate in the criminal justice system. So that individual is assigned the social worker. The social worker is their voice. They interview the client, get their medical records. For example, in the pilot program, of the 229 adults and juveniles who were served through the pilot, the social workers gathered over 300 records total, criminal records, medical records, all, you know, the kind of detail that judges are going to rely on, the mitigating evidence or proof that that individual has some kind of deep-seated economic, social, or medical problem. They talk to family members. They get school records, all those kinds of things. They put together a plan that that individual needs to succeed in society, so the kind of treatment that they need. They present the plan with the attorneys in the courtroom to the judge. And so, in other words, a lot of judges are very afraid of, like, releasing someone on shock or dismissing a case, you know, or diverting someone to treatment because they're not, you know, always positive that individual is going to get the treatment that they need. So the social worker kind of is that individual's advocate, and there's really not anybody in the criminal justice system who's doing that right now. So the judge is able to rely on, if they order that person to treatment, that they're actually going to go there. And so, for example, in Moorhead, you ask about Moorhead, Sarah Grimes, who's a social worker there, she's LCSW, she's knowledgeable, she has a history of working with individuals with substance abuse problems. So she was able to find Unite vouchers and find the resources that sort of opened the door to treatment facilities that the judge wouldn't have had time to find or wouldn't have, you know, been able to get that person in particular, you know, treatment facilities all the way across the state even. So we were able to find treatment for people in adjacent states, adjacent counties, and then I guess on the latter end, when somebody goes into treatment and then comes out and goes in back into the community, we call that reentry, the social worker follows up. So essentially that person is an advocate from the beginning of that individual's criminal disposition all the way into reentry into the community.
Okay, and you mentioned a judge maybe not having the time to find a rehabilitation center for someone, but some might argue that this is what the prison system is for, is the rehabilitation that you guys are doing. So would you say that on that level, the system has failed, perhaps, and you're picking up and doing what it should be doing?
Well, I would say that that the criminal justice system is, they say, like a three-legged stool. And one of the jobs is to re-educate people and teach them how to transform themselves or to help transform them. The other is to provide treatment. And the other is to, penalize them in some way. And I feel like we really have designed a system, particularly in jails. Professor Bob Lawson at UK Law School I've heard him often say that the war on drugs is not working, being tough on crime is not working, that we really need to be smart on crime. And part of that being smart is to invest in treatment and education. Treatment is transformational. Treatment is transformational. Job training is transformational. Tough on crime and the war on drugs clearly is not, because we have more drug felons than ever before in history, but yet we've had, you know, a greater number of sentences imposed on us than ever. So,
what kind of results is your program? Did the pilot see?
Well, we have the findings are pretty significant, actually, similar to that of drug court. Drug court is effective. It's working because of the kind of intensive case management that they're providing to individuals, that prescribed treatment that people need. And we, of the four social workers, we covered 17 rural and urban counties, and we treated 229 adults and juveniles in the 1 year. And of those, the great majority of them, as I said before, were addicted to drug or alcohol, and a good number of them also had mental illness, and a large majority had both. They were dual diagnosed. So of those who had signs of alcohol and drug addiction and who were referred to treatment, 72% of them actually stayed in treatment or completed treatment, which is pretty remarkable. And 67 of those with mental health, signs of mental health or problems, 67 of those stayed or completed treatment. I guess the other two markers in terms of savings is the recidivism rate. We had 18% recidivism versus 34% in the correction system, which is significantly less. And the most remarkable thing, I think, that we're hoping that legislators will look to in the coming month is that the savings to Kentucky is around $3.1 million. So essentially the pilot paid for itself, and it returned, could potentially return $3.1 million to the state.
All right. Thank you very much for the time.
Thanks, Gabe.
When we come back, Elizabeth Kramer looks at a growing trend among independent booksellers cultivating online communities. You're in Studio 619 on WFTL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Coming up a little later in the show, I'll speak with Walt Pavlo, author of the book Stolen Without a Gun. First, independent booksellers nationwide faced a slew of setbacks last year. They included a slump in book sales and the news that Americans are reading less for pleasure, as the National Endowment for the Arts spelled out in a report released in November. Rather than ceding to those challenges, many independents are capitalizing on the technologies offered by the World Wide Web to reach their communities. WFPL's Elizabeth Kramer reports.
On Lexington's South Side, Joseph Beth Booksellers is more than a mere bookstore. There are kids playing in an area downstairs, and adults are sipping warm drinks in a cafe complete with a fireplace on the main floor. Talk to someone amid the stacks here, and you'll likely find customers who maintain their rapport with this bricks-and-mortar establishment by visiting the store's website more often than they visit the store itself. One is Alicia Hart, who lives about 20 miles north in the town of Midway.
I'm a member of a book club that meets here once a month, and I do like to check the website to see if there are going to be writers here that are going to be reading their works or signing their books or anything, if it's something that maybe my book club has read or would be interested in reading.
While polling several people here, I find that they use the site to learn about more than events. They purchase gift cards, join awards programs, read staff recommendations, and even check out the cafe's menu. Store manager Gary Cremines tells me these functions harness the passion and expertise of the company's sales staff and give people reasons to ultimately come to the store. Using the website in this way is not new, but only in recent years have local brick-and-mortar stores begun to embrace specific web tools that drive foot traffic and strengthen customer loyalty. Charles Steinfeld is a communications professor at Michigan State University. He studied how brick-and-mortar businesses are using e-commerce. He says booksellers, along with restaurants and malls, are brick-and-mortar industries that have experimented the most with internet capabilities to enhance their services. He says putting the internet to good use is vital for today's brick-and-mortar retailers.
You have to manage for a multi-channel retail process. You can't just assume it's going to work by itself.
Many in the independent bookselling community share Steinfeld's views. One indication is the attention the American Booksellers Association gives to the subject. This week, when 500 members from nearly 300 stores meet in Louisville for its winter conference, there will be sessions on website development, online social networking, and printing books on demand. One of those attending is Dave Weish, who is director of marketing for the behemoth independent bookseller Powell's Books in Oregon. For the past 10 years, Weish has worked to develop Powells.com to draw people nationwide to purchase books on the website and get locals in the Portland area to frequent its 6 stores there. Its site has search engines, blogs, contests, ebooks, and more. But Weish is quick to point out that these features aren't just bells and whistles.
Inevitably, the work that we do has to generate a return. That return does not necessarily have to be strictly a sales measure, but it has to be customer loyalty, media attention. I mean, there has to be something to justify dedicating resources to it.
Weish readily admits resources are scarce in the bookselling business with its small profit margins. Still, he says that experimenting on the web and constantly evaluating those efforts are crucial to staying alive. That means maintaining current readers and cultivating new ones in the marketplace where the younger generation is so engaged by technology. It's an outlook that isn't lost on Michael Link, who works out of Joseph Beth Booksellers Executive Office in Cincinnati.
We look at the interests and values of this coming generation and how we can best get reading front and center for them, because that's ultimately our goal, is to provide the discourse that happens in books.
That discourse could provide people with the inspiration to read in a time when Americans between the ages of 15 and 24 spend almost 2 hours of their daily leisure time watching TV and only 7 minutes reading. For WFPL, I'm Elizabeth Kramer.
Walt Pavlo is coming to Louisville this week to speak to students and faculty at U of L's College of Business. Pavlo spent 2 years in a federal prison for embezzling some $6 million from MCI Communications, where he was an executive in the collections department, and where he says he took part in a scheme to artificially inflate the company's stock price. Since his release from prison, Walt Pavlo has been telling his cautionary tale to corporate employees and business students across the country. He's also co-authored a book, Stolen Without a Gun. He spoke to Studio 619 from his home in Tampa, Florida. Well, Walt, let's start at the beginning of your employment with MCI. When did you start working for them?
Well, I started working there in 1992, shortly after I had just gotten my MBA, and I was looking for a new job. I'd been in the defense industry, and the job that they wanted me for was in their reseller division, companies that bought long distance and then resold it under their brand name. Most of them you've heard of, AT&T and Sprint, WorldCom, which was one of our largest customers. But it was, you know, it was a job collecting money, really doing a lot of credit negotiations, contract negotiations, and settling billing disputes. And we managed probably in the hundreds of millions of dollars each month of accounts receivable, and I was responsible for collecting the money and then, you know, posting it, making sure that their checks were properly applied to their account.
So you're young, I assume, and eager to move up the ladder.
Well, it seemed so. I was 29 when I started to work there, and within a few years, I've been promoted a few times, and things were going well, and I was well compensated, and it was a lot of responsibility. And quite honestly, I really enjoyed the job. It was an opportunity for somebody young and innovative in a recently deregulated environment, which was telecom, to really step forward and move up. And I did very well in that environment.
So let's fast forward to the wrong turn here. What happened?
Well, there was a series of wrong turns. I think, like anything else, Rick, that there's a number of decisions that you do that one can make, and I just kept going down a wrong path. And it really started when a number of MCI's long distance companies stopped paying their bill. And I don't mean Sprint and AT&T and WorldCom. I mean little small long distance startups, ABC Telecom or something that could have been in any small town, started running up large long distance bills and not being able to pay them. And obviously that poses a problem at MCI. And it got to be by 1995, just a little over 3 years after I'd been there, that these numbers of carriers, long distance companies weren't paying their bill, started to mount into the hundreds of millions of dollars. So it was it was not just one; there was a bunch of them, and they were kind of shady business practices that were going on. But rather than report that, what we thought at MCI, by reported, I mean write it off or tell shareholders we're not going to get this money, we started to manipulate the financial earnings, if you will, to disguise this bad debt from shareholders. And really our initial thought was, this is just an anomaly. It's just going to be a short downturn. We'll find other better paying customers or get our money back if we take them to civil litigation. But that turned out not to be the case. And, we just kept, I guess for lack of a better term, we kept having to hide the money. The other thing that's happening about this time is that MCI's is in play as a takeover candidate. There's a number of incentives for us to keep the stock price up, and before we know it, we've been doing it for quite a while.
So all this time, you're also correct me if I'm wrong, collecting money on the side.
Well, that's what after I'd been manipulating the money with the company for a while, I became very disenchanted with what was going on, and for whatever reason, made another bad decision. I got in with another guy, and we had some idea of where we could capitalize on this, and maybe in the process rationalized that we could also help MCI out. And we started doing some creative financing with some of these really bad customers of MCI's, and in the process diverting money to Cayman Island accounts. And that before long, it didn't take very long. Within 6 months, we'd put almost $6 million over in the Cayman Islands and in a very short period of time. And I was overwhelmed by how well it worked and the consequences now. What does this really mean for me? And that's when I really started thinking, I could get myself in a lot of trouble here.
Did you feel guilty during this time?
I felt terrible. I really did. That's not to say, and just being honest, that I didn't go out and have some fun and blow some money and things like that. But I can tell you, every time I laid down to go to bed at night, it was like, what have I done? How do I get back out of this? Can I give the money back? Is this downturn going to be so bad that, in the end, I'm going to end up getting caught with my finger in there, or my hand in the cookie jar here? And it was overwhelming. It became a balancing act of trying to do my real job and then, covering up some of my own misdealings that I was doing on the side.
So how did you get caught?
Well, I think it was my conscience eventually caught me before anybody else did. It was just, it is overwhelming. I think one of the things that I often talk about when I speak to students is that I grossly underestimated the pressure that I would feel being involved in something like this. Any retribution I thought I was getting or, greed of the money that I could get was soon overcome by just a very fragile mental state to where I just really couldn't function anymore. And in the process of my normal job, my boss had come across an accounting entry that he thought was, was like suspect or like, hey, what's going on here? And, asked me to look into it. And when he did, I really just panicked when he told me the name of the account, which was something that I was familiar with that meant that I had been moving money. And I just said, I don't know what it is. I don't want to talk about it. And I quit my job. So I quit. And you can imagine things unravel pretty quickly from there because they look into it and find out what it is, and sort of all trails lead back to me.
And this, of course, becomes a criminal case then.
Absolutely. You know, first I'm approached by MCI internal investigators and their corporate lawyers, like, hey, what, you know, first you got to think that they may think there's a crime or something has gone wrong, but at first they're like, you know, what has gone wrong? And then they start looking into it and they go, oh my goodness, this looks bad. And then after a while, you know, they know that something really criminal has gone on. And they start cooperating with the authorities, saying, "Hey, I think we've got something large here." I've hired a lawyer by then, and probably a year after I left MCI, I received a letter through my lawyer from the U.S. Attorney's Office indicating that I was a focus of a federal investigation.
So, was there a trial, or did you plead guilty?
I eventually did plead guilty. I took a while to do that. It took after I'd received that target letter, probably over 2 years before I began to cooperate. During that time, I took precautions that I wouldn't say anybody would take, but ones that I thought were right. I moved my family, from Atlanta, Georgia, where some of the press had gotten a hold of my story. I didn't want my family, my kids particularly, to be subjected to the criticism that might come out of that, and moved them to a small town in southern Georgia, and really prepared myself for the inevitable, which was going to be prison. And once I got my family settled in and, knew that there was just really no way out, I had to figure out a way to put it behind me, and that was to plead guilty. So there was no trial. I turned myself in, cooperated 100% with the authorities, and accepted a guilty plea that put me in prison for a little over 2 years.
So how was that adjustment going to federal prison?
Oh, it's one heck of a fall, just going from being someone who is admired not only among your business associates but your family and friends to telling them that you're going to prison. Probably one of the most difficult things that I had to do. I would often think that it's easier to tell your family and friends that you have a terminal illness than to say you're going to prison. It's something that's easier to grasp, but to tell them that you're going to prison just seems something so foreign. And everybody's frightened. They're frightened for themselves as to what's going to happen. They're also frightened for me. What situation is he getting himself into? What is prison like? And, what's going to happen to him when he gets in there?
And you had two young boys at the time, correct?
I did. They were ages 9 and 10 when I told them that I was going away. And, the story that you tell a 9 or 10-year-old is going to be, different than you tell them, their ages now, which is 16 and 18. They constantly ask questions about what went wrong and how to deal with it and handle it. I mean, we've since moved through a great deal of that, but I can tell you, it's still this crime took place over 11 years ago, and it's still something that comes up from time to time in a very serious matter of what went wrong, why did you do this, how did it happen, are you okay now? I mean, they're cautious kids, but we've since moved over, moved beyond, well beyond that, but still questions persist.
What did you do while you were in prison to sort of make the time go by a little faster?
Well, the prison's sort of a self-paced program. They put you in there, and they want you to learn the lesson in there. There's really no defined program as to how you do your time or you're behind bars, and you're given a lot of free time. And I used mine a lot to reflect on what I had done. And it was an odd time, really, to be in prison because as I was in there, I watched the meltdown of Enron and WorldCom and, some of these other major meltdowns that we saw out there, particularly in telecommunications and in the energy sector. And, it was a time for me to really reflect, like, wow, there was a lot of stuff that I was doing wrong, even, beyond, what I had done, with my co-conspirator to put money in the Cayman Islands. There was a much deeper problem that was going on in business at the time. And I used a lot of time just to reflect. I did a lot of exercising to relieve myself of the burden of being in there. I think through exercise you release some endorphins that help you get through it. And I did a lot of reading and beyond that a lot of reflection about how did I get here, and why are there the other thing I reflect on too, Rick, is why are other people in here, that are very similarly situated to me, other white collar felons? They seem like nice people. How did they get here? What went wrong with them? And do they realize what they've done wrong?
So you served the full term, a little over 2 years?
I did. I served a little over 2 years, and then after that I had 3 years of what they call supervised release, which is a kind of a probationary period where you're reporting in once a month on what you're doing, how much money you're making, who you're associating with, what are your expenses, I mean, a really, you know, detailed look at your life. Where do you travel to? You know, that was all also restricted. There were, you know, a number of things that that I was restricted from doing and had to get permission to go pretty much anywhere outside of a district or a county. Beyond that, I've been ordered to pay over $5 million in restitution, which I still pay on today, and will for, you know, another 20 years. I mean, it's going to be a part of my life until I'm in my 60s.
So you had to look for a job when you got out, and how was that?
That was difficult. I mean, prison, as difficult as prison was, and I don't want to sugarcoat, you know, what it was even beyond the boredom. I mean, it's terrible being away from your family. That was probably the least part of the punishment. You know, trying to find a job, mending relationships is extremely difficult. But, you know, when I first got out, I assumed, well, I've served my time. I've done something wrong. I acknowledge that I've done something wrong, and I'm going to tell the world I did something wrong, but that's, you know, I'm not going to repeat it again. But that doesn't guarantee you a job. In fact, you know, I tried to get a job, you know, starting out in things that I knew in a finance-related area, and I can tell you, there were none to be had. There was no one that was going to hire me right out of prison. And, you know, that became one of the things that I just, it might sound weird, but I was shocked by it. It was like, wow, I didn't think about this. How am I going to get a job now? And it was extremely difficult. And I started at that time thinking about, you know, what else could I do? And the FBI had me, of all people, recruited me to do some training for some FBI agents and U.S. attorneys, and because they were experiencing this, you know, uptick in white-collar crime with Enron and whatnot. And, you know, it allowed me to make a little money while I was out there to do some speaking engagements. And that's lasted 3 or 4 years now.
And is that your full-time job now?
It is. It is. But I will tell you this. My time on stage talking about this instance is limited. You know, we're now seeing a mortgage fraud that's rearing its ugly head. And there's a number of other things that will probably come up. But my time is limited, and basically what I've used this for is to not only educate people about white-collar crime, particularly students, but to distance myself from what I did and to say, you know, I've tried to find a way to give back and to move on with my life. But it takes a lot of time, and only now are some opportunities starting to present themselves where I can actually talk to a prospective employer and say, hey, you know, I've learned my lesson. This is what I've done, and this is how I'm ready to move on. But, you know, speaking about a crime is not a lifetime job that you can do.
What kind of response do you get from the students and others that you speak to?
Well, I think that in general, they want to know what happens and what does the person look like. And I think that a number of people have in their mind what a white-collar criminal looks like, and they think that they look different, that they're, you know, that they're much different than what, you know, a general professional audience looks like. And the shock that they get is like, wow, this is somebody that I feel like I could have worked with when they look at me, or this is somebody that I feel like I could have worked for, and that's frightening. And then they're really interested in the consequences, something that I don't think is covered very much in the media. You know, they talk about prison and stuff, but, you know, just like the question earlier about how do you find a job, they go, wow, I never thought of that, neither did I. What was the impact on your family? What was your impact on your financial situation? You know, how do you move on from here? And I think it takes a deeper look at what the consequences are of white-collar crime beyond the two or three paragraphs that you read in the paper about, you know, Joe or Sue has been sent to prison for embezzling $5 million, and, you know, that end of story. You know, what are the real implications of and consequences of a white-collar crime? And I believe that I'm able to present that.
And you have written a book about your experience as well.
I did. I actually wrote the book, Stolen Without a Gun, while I was in prison. And it was really, again, going back to my earlier comment, a reflection on, you know, what did I do wrong? Where did it start going wrong? Because I'm often asked that by audiences. Where do you think you could have turned back? Why didn't you turn back? And I had those same questions. And when I wrote Stolen Without a Gun, I said, well, let me think about where it all started, you know, the good, and then just slowly progress. And really the book is a more detailed presentation of really what I saw went wrong. And I co-wrote the book with Neil Weinberg, from senior editor at Forbes, who saw in that story kind of some global lessons about, you know, where people go wrong and how the slope just gets steeper and slippier, you know, more slippery, as time goes on.
That was former MCI executive Walt Pavlo, who spent 2 years in a federal prison for white-collar crimes. His new book is called Stolen Without a Gun. He'll speak this week to students and faculty at the University of Louisville College of Business. When we come back, Robin Fisher talks parenting with the Sweet Potato Queen, otherwise known as author Jill Connor Brown. You're in Studio 619 on WFPL. Welcome back to Studio 619. I'm Rick Heldet. Well, maybe you are doing it right now, sitting there getting ready to pull out your hair because your child won't eat or she won't stop hitting her little brother or your son insists on cursing. Don't fret, you're not alone. WFPL's Robin Fisher talks about parenting advice and tales of woe with Jill Connor Brown, author of The Sweet Potato Queen's Guide to Raising Children for Fun and Profit.
So briefly tell us, who are the Sweet Potato Queens?
That's a good question. I started the Sweet Potato Queens in 1982 in Jackson, Mississippi, where I'm from, when my friend Malcolm White, local restaurateur, entrepreneur, decided for no apparent reason that Jackson needed a St. Patrick's Day parade. It's not like there's a whole pile of Irish people there or anything, although I am one. And he got a parade permit, and Daddy brought us up to believe that spectating was a sin, that if there was anything going on that you were in any way capable of participating in, you had a moral obligation to do so. And so, you know, in the South, we've got a beauty queen for every day of the week, every organization, every food group. And I declared myself to be the Sweet Potato Queen just because I thought it sounded funny and still do. And today, the parade is one of the largest in the country. It's the only one that anybody can show up and be in. You can be the queen of whatever you choose. And it's all a benefit for the Blair E. Batson Children's Hospital, which is the only children's hospital in Mississippi where any child can be treated regardless of ability to pay. So we have a great time, and we do good work.
Now, did I read somewhere that you have thousands of Sweet Potato Queens that show up for the parade?
Yes, there are about 5,400 chapter groups in 22 countries, including Saudi Arabia, and they pretty much all of them show up. It's the Million Queen March, and they come to Jackson in the third weekend in March, and it is a sight to behold. If you go to my website, sweetpotatoqueens.com, you can see in the gallery photos of past parades, and it is the creativity is astounding.
Now, what was the first book?
The first book was The Sweet Potato Queen's Book of Love, followed by God Save the Sweet Potato Queens, then The Sweet Potato Queen's Big Ass Cookbook and Financial Planner, The Sweet Potato Queen's Field Guide to Men, Every Man I Love is Either Married, Gay, or Dead, The Sweet Potato Queen's Wedding Planner and Divorce Guide, The Sweet Potato Queen's First Big Ass Novel, Stuff We Didn't Actually Do But Could Have and May Yet, and this newest one, which is The Sweet Potato Queen's Guide to Raising Children for Fun and Profit.
Now, it seems to fall, you know, right in line, you know, love, you know, men, marriage. But tell us about this book.
Well, I hope that the humor is just the vehicle by which the greater message is delivered. But if all you get out of any of my books is a laugh, then I have served you well, because life is hard on a good day.
Well, talk to us about the alpha moms and the beta moms, because I got a laugh out of that, because
yeah,
while I am not a mom, I would definitely fall into the beta mom category.
Yes, it's, you're either an alpha person or a beta. The alpha moms, I think, make their own dirt. They are beyond my realm of, and so if there's alpha, and then the beta moms would be where all you get asked to bring the trash bags and paper napkins to events, but I would probably fall in the omega category if we were really classifying them.
You have a funny chapter on in here about children cursing.
I do have quite a potty mouth myself. Daddy always brought us up to believe that there is no such thing as a bad word. There's only bad intent in your heart, and that people made up all words and assigned all meaning to those words, and that he would use the example, it was always the neat freak husband and the slob housewife and the inch thick dust on the coffee table. And so the guy, instead of dusting the table himself, which was always a mystery to me, well, if it bothered him so much, why didn't he just dust it? But he would write in the dust, "I love you." And now she would come along and write, "I love you too." Now, neither of these people have communicated a feeling of love for the other. Neither has felt loved when they read the message. And so Daddy's point was always, if we think if God judges anything, do you not think he's got sense enough to judge what's in your heart as opposed to what comes out of your mouth? Because I could cuss you up one side and down the other, but the expression on my face and the tone of my voice, you would feel nothing but terms of endearment. At the same time, I could say I love you in tones so dripping in venom, you would know that in my heart I had consigned you to the darkest regions. And so that... my mother did not share this opinion, however. Well, and so my theory is if your kids are going to cuss, insist that they sit down and learn to cuss in Shakespearean terms, which is very flowery and powerful.
Another chapter that I am the oldest child of four.
Uh-huh.
And the chapter about when you have that second child, about being an older sibling, I thought was hilarious.
I don't think my sister has ever gotten over them bringing me home from the hospital. But, you know, for 6 years, she was completely happy. She was the center of the universe, the only apple in the family eye. And then they came home with this baby that they never took back. But she's been scarred for life.
Now, will you tell us the story about the little boy who got to pick his brother's middle name?
They were, you know, misguided parents, you know, trying to make the older brother feel special and feel included and all that. So they said, tell them that he could pick the new baby's middle name. And so he thought and thought and thought. And a few days later, he came back and said that he had chosen the name Peter. And they thought, oh, because it wasn't the dog's name and it wasn't a TV character. You know, they thought he had really given a lot of thought and chosen his new little brother's middle name until they said it with his first name, which was Sawyer.
And then we all know from there. Now, despite your protest at the beginning of the book, there is actually some real and valid parenting advice hidden in these pages.
Yes.
Now, was that intentional?
Well, I mean, I do have, you know, I have some experience in the matter, and I've also had reams of experiences shared with me by queens from all over the world. So yes, there is some sound advice in there, although, you know, delivered with very tongue-in-cheek.
What's your favorite chapter in the book?
Oh, I don't think I have a favorite. I love the cover of the book, which is my own personal daughter when she was 9 months old. And, of course, she's 20 now, and you would have thought when I asked her if I could use that photograph that I had asked her to pose naked in a bowl today. But it's all near and dear to my heart because it's, you know, a lot of it is about my raising my own daughter. But then the experiences are so universal. I mean, my voice is that spoken and written is that of a Southern female because that's what I luckily turned out to be. But the experiences are completely universal.
If you could give a copy of this book to everyone, who do you think should own this book?
Well, everyone absolutely should buy this book. No one should ever loan any of my books because I have massive plastic surgery needs that will never be met if people are loaning the books.
All right. Well, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
That was WFPL's Robin Fisher talking with author Jill Connor Brown about the latest installment in the Sweet Potato Queens series, The Sweet Potato Queen's Guide to Raising Children for Fun and Profit. You can learn more about Brown on our website, WFPL.org. More information about today's show is available online at WFPL.org. You can email us from there or listen to previous broadcasts in our audio archive. You can also write to us at Studio 619, 619 South 4th Street, Louisville, Kentucky, 40202. Or you can reach us by phone at Studio 619 is produced by the Public Radio Partnership. Everything you hear on Studio 619 is compiled by the staff at PRP, which includes WFPL, WFPK, and WUOL. We also air submissions from Kentucky Public Radio, a collaboration of all the public radio stations in the Commonwealth. I'm Rick Howlett. Join us next time for another edition of Studio 619 on WFPL.